We would like to take a moment to thank our sponsor, Preborn. When a mother meets her baby on an ultrasound and hears their heartbeat, it's a divine connection, and the majority of the time, she will choose life. But she can't do it without our help. Preborn needs us, the pro-life community, to come alongside her. One ultrasound is just $28. To donate, dial #250 and say the keyword baby, or visit preborn.com.
The American Family Association's mission is to inform, equip, and activate individuals to strengthen the moral foundations of our culture. We also support the church. Our goal is to be a leading organization in biblical worldview training for cultural transformation. We believe true morality flows from biblical principles and directs people to the manner in which God intends them to live.
Thank you for standing with the American Family Association as we seek to stop the erosion of godly values. Jenna Ellis in the Morning on American Family Radio.
I love talking about the things of God because of truth and the biblical worldview.
The U.S. Constitution obligates our government to preserve and protect the rights that our founders recognize come from God, our Creator, not our government.
I believe that Scripture in the Bible is very clear that God is the one that raised up each of you, and God has allowed us to be brought here to this specific moment in time.
This is Jenna Ellis in the Morning.
Good morning. It is Thursday, August 29th, and we are talking on a grander scale of the contrast of the worldview differences in the policies between the two major parties, the two major candidates for president, and then all the way down ticket, because we should always be concerned what worldview is put onto the ballot and what we are voting for and understand what the consequences of that is. And so as a great example of how the left, and particularly the Democrats, want to not just redistribute wealth, but also redistribute debt. Joe Biden is continuing to push this whole forgiveness of student loans issue. And a lot of people are saying that that's more of a vote buying effort, which of course it is, because those who are younger students or people who just don't really understand what socialism or communism actually means just view it as, well, great, I can major in underwater basket weaving and then go teach that as a professor with a PhD and not really contribute much, but then have $200,000 worth of debt from, you know, Yale or Harvard or one of these DEI institutions, and the student loan will be forgiven, and that's totally fine with them. And yet the Supreme Court, thankfully, yesterday declined to reinstate the Biden administration's latest plan to cancel student debt for millions of borrowers, this coming from CBS this morning, leaving them in limbo while the appeals process plays out. The justices turned down a request from the Justice Department to lift a sweeping appeals court order that blocked the program known as the SAVE plan, which has been the subject of legal challenges from more than a dozen GOP-led states in recent months. The court said in an unsigned order that it, quote, expects that the Court of Appeals will render its decision with appropriate dispatch. There were no noted dissents. Its order leaves the injunction from the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Eighth Circuit in place for now. So the Education Department paused loans payments for borrowers enrolled in the program earlier this month because of the ongoing legal proceedings. Mr. Biden's attempt to provide relief to, well, that's CBS's relief, right, to millions of Americans has not fared well before the Supreme Court, which last year struck down an earlier plan that would have benefited more than 40 million Americans and probably disadvantaged everybody else. And forgiven nearly $500 billion in loans. But of course, that money goes elsewhere. So let's bring on our special guest this morning, Gerard Folletti, who is the senior counsel at the Lawfare Project. So Gerard, this was a good decision from the Supreme Court. And where do we expect this to go from here?
It's a very good decision from the U.S. Supreme Court. And now this case will continue in two places, the Eighth Circuit and the Tenth Circuit, because there are two different lawsuits that have been filed against this measure. And those courts will determine the ultimate outcome. Now, where it goes from there, I think that both sides will appeal. Whichever loses will appeal to the U.S. Supreme Court. So we will see this case back on the docket next year. But at least by then, we will have more clarity as to what the lower courts were thinking.
Yeah. So how could this even possibly have an outcome favorable to Joe Biden? I mean, because, you know, just forgiving student loans, that's basically a redistribution of debt and doesn't seem to make sense under an American capitalist system. I mean, what is their argument here?
Well, that's exactly what this is. This is redistribution of debt. This is a change in the compact between the government and people who borrowed money for college loans who promised to repay it. And the issue ultimately is that you are favoring a group of people by wiping off their debt for college degrees that they earn that are not perhaps as productive as they would have liked them to be, and instead shifting that burden to all American taxpayers to pay for these people's education. And that is fundamentally unfair, but it's also problematic because when you're looking at the cost, you're looking at close to half a trillion dollars, $400 and change billion that this would cost the U.S. taxpayers. And when you get to numbers that are that high, the courts are starting to look on whether agencies like the Department of Education can make these rules without Congress actually passing a law. So that is really what the issue is, whether President Biden can, by executive decree, make these things happen without Congress allowing it when we're talking about that much money.
Yeah, and it should outrage common sense Americans and those of us who actually, you know, earn money for a living, pay our student loans, you know, those types of things, to not have Joe Biden essentially out there trying to buy votes. I mean, this is basically just a scheme to have more favorable PR, especially heading into an election year. And this now marks almost 40 days that Kamala Harris has not done a press conference. She hasn't talked really about any sort of specific policy. She's leaving that really vague. Do we know anything about where she stands on this particular issue? Because this has really been in the media as more of a Biden issue. But I mean, she's in the current administration.
We do know that when she's run for office in the past, she's made comments about the cost of education being too high and the need to make it more affordable to all Americans. She has commented in the past on the burden of student debt, but we don't know where she stands. We believe that she is, I mean, this is the Biden-Harris administration, so there's no reason to think that she's not in lockstep with her boss and shares his beliefs on this. And I will bet money that she will take credit for this plan if it actually ends up being successful. So this is really a part of the ideology of the Democratic Party and of Kamala Harris to shift the burden from people who owe money to all of Americans, to basically socialize the education system and the country. So I think that she finds this very favorable.
Yeah, I would agree with that assessment. And I'm talking to Gerard Folletti, who's the senior counsel at the Lawfare Project. You can follow him on X as well. And is this sort of a test balloon case in terms of the overall goal of socialism and to redistribute wealth and debt that we know that Kamala Harris and Joe Biden stand for? I mean, if they can do this with student loan debt, are they going to likely try this in other areas?
I think what we're seeing is that we're seeing the Democrats, especially Biden-Harris, they're pushing the envelope. They're looking to see what they can get away with, what dollar amount falls below the threshold at which the Supreme Court says this is really a major questions doctrine issue and it should go to Congress and not the administration. They're seeing what they can get away with. Is it $500 billion? Is it $200 billion? What costs can they incur on the American public in terms of these programs before the Supreme Court steps in to shut it down? So this is what they're doing. They're testing the waters. If they're successful here, we can see much more broadly implemented measures that will redistribute the economic burden on programs and basically cost all American taxpayers more money for less benefit. If they don't succeed in this, they'll keep trying.
So what has been suggested then by the Republicans in terms of outrageous student loan debt? Because obviously, you know, this isn't a good solution. It's not an American constitutional solution. It's not a capitalist solution. But for the millions of Americans that do struggle with student loan debt, I mean, it is outrageous that, you know, some of these universities are requiring these types of sums of student loans for degrees that really don't have a lot of earning potential. And obviously, the individuals are agreeing to this. I mean, they're not being coerced. They're choosing their major. They're choosing the institution that they attend. And so they're voluntarily agreeing to this. But at the same time, there is a point to be made that the student loan repay back whole industry is almost, I mean, I think of it almost like the health insurance model, that there is no way that the actual price that they charge is the cost of the benefit that's provided.
Oh, absolutely. And if you look at what's been happening on college campuses, especially in the last year, you're seeing students paying exorbitant fees for tuition to learn what? To learn how to hate Jews, to learn how to protest American democracy. You're not seeing them learn skills or trades or anything that's going to be practical in life. You're seeing college campuses devolve into anarchy at a high cost to students that now the government wants to pass on to all taxpayers. This is outrageous. There should be something done about the high costs of college. Because students are not getting the benefit of what they're paying for. And just like we've seen inflation everywhere else in the last 4 years, we've seen tuitions rise significantly. They probably doubled in the last 25 years. And what are students getting out of it? This is something that Republicans do need a better agenda for. But that agenda really goes to asking the questions of why college costs so much. Where is that money going? Is that money going into teaching students, or is it going into DEI programs? Is it going into staff that are teaching or inculcating values that are anti-American? Because if that's where the money's going, then the federal government needs to rethink how it issues student loans. It needs to rethink how it supports colleges. Colleges would need to start justifying the tuitions that they're paying. I think that's the line that Republicans need to be taking, because everyone is fed up with what's going on in the education system.
Yeah, well, and I hope that the Trump campaign is listening to your comments this morning, because, you know, those are great notes in terms of talking points and a rationale against Biden's solution, because everybody does know that, you know, these student loan rates are outrageous, and there doesn't seem to be a great solution other than, you know, Biden saying, oh, okay, well, we'll just forgive everything, and then everybody's going, oh, well, that's great, if they don't actually understand the end result of that policy and the whole debt redistribution. And so President Trump has said that he will dismantle the Department of Education on the federal level as a federal agency should he return to the White House. I mean, and that, of course, is, you know, more for the K through 12. But in terms of where his education policy is focused, I mean, that's a really good step. I wish he had done that in his first administration. But what do we know about what promises, campaign promises, at least, that he's made in terms of overall education challenges in the United States for the 2024 election?
I wouldn't necessarily call them campaign promises, but some of the things that he has talked to in recent months do go to the issues of DEI. They do go to the issues of what higher education is actually teaching students. I think that he would be inclined to rein in, just like many governors have done, the extent to which the extent to which these schools can use federal funds to teach things that are not actually educational, that go more towards inculcating negative social values. He has also talked about looking at the funding of these schools and how much the government pays, especially when you have when you see what's been happening on college campuses and seeing the anti-American activities, reining in how much the government spends on it. So I think he does have the makings of a very good policy. I also think, though, that the problem Donald Trump is facing right now is that the media is fawning all over Kamala Harris, so it's hard for him to get some of his messaging out.
Yeah, although now they have agreed to a debate, and that will take place on September 10th. And hopefully there will be more policy, not just some of the, you know, the mudslinging back and forth. And hopefully the debate format will allow that, because I think it's important that these types of contrasts on issues like education policy, like DEI, you know, what are we actually teaching our students? What's going into even K through 12 curriculum? And obviously on the state level, there's a lot of great Republican governors, like, you know, here in the state of Florida, Governor DeSantis, and also Superintendent Ryan Walters, who's a great conservative hero out in Oklahoma. I mean, there are a lot of people on the state level that are doing these things. But when that debate happens, we hopefully will see the contrast in policy between some concrete measures that Trump wants to take. And Kamala Harris so far has just been able to be very vague, and she's not pinning down her specific policy, which I think is problematic for voters.
It's very problematic for voters. I think so far, the only thing that I heard that comes close to a policy pronouncement during the Democratic convention was when she said she would have a pathway to citizenship for illegal immigrants. That's the closest thing to policy on anything that she said, that and raising taxes on everyone. But we need to see more policy. We need the candidates to actually get into specifics. And sometimes the issues, you know, there are sleeper issues, even within education. One of the things, for example, that no one has really addressed is the power of the unions, on the teachers' unions, on what happens in the schools, and how you could have Republican governors, you could have federal law that does a lot to stop some of the bad parts of DEI, but so long as you have teachers who are being backed by unions to keep promoting this in the classroom, it's going to continue being a war. What's being done about that? That's one example of how specific we need to get candidates talking about issues.
We really do. Well, hopefully ABC will do its job. We'll see about that. But Gerard Folletti, always really appreciate your comments. And yeah, Kamala Harris, her only promise is to raise taxes, which is, again, more wealth redistribution. And the conservative principle, and of course the biblical principle, is that you get to keep what you earn. So we shouldn't be voting for higher taxes and canceling student loans and all kinds of socialist policies that go against the principles of Scripture. We'll be right back with more here on Jenna Ellis in the Morning.
Welcome back to Jenna Ellis in the Morning on American Family Radio.
Welcome back. Well, speaking of all of the push for diversity, equity, and inclusion, or DEI, there is so much that the left is continuing to push. And they actually do have a cohesive worldview for the most part in terms of the policy that they are pushing. Because if you look at all of the things that they are pushing for, it's basically antithetical to truth. And we know that our central value as Christians, what we need to primarily be voting in terms of our value, and yes, we need to participate in our civil government. This is part of the blessing of liberty, that we live in a society that we can actually exercise our vote. We can impact and affect our government, unlike Christians who have lived in other societies throughout history, where even though the Bible says that we need to live godly lives in the midst of even a pagan society, we see that in 1 Peter 2, where the Bible commands that. So we can live Christian lives even in the midst of whatever is going on in the government. When we have the opportunity, as we do here in America, to affect those who are in power over us, our leaders, we have the blessing of liberty to select and prefer our leaders, we need to take that opportunity. And there are so many races. I mean, this is not just about the presidential ticket. This isn't just about that contrast at the top of the ticket, which I think can be best expressed not in terms of Democrat and Republican or even personality of, you know, whether you like the gal pal of Kamala Harris or you like the mean tweets of Donald Trump, but rather as a worldview expression, and which conforms more with truth. Do we want America to be transformed into a Marxist socialist country that says that, you know, everyone should own nothing and be happy, and we can continue to redistribute wealth, we can redistribute debt, and continue with this with inflation and have the economy so outrageous we can continue to foreclose and infringe upon parental rights and continue to say that somehow kids can change their gender and have gender mutilation surgeries. They can be taught about diversity, equity, and inclusion in schools. I mean, that's the communist Marxist utopia that the left prefers and is trying desperately to implement. And this is why in the last segment, when we're talking about these types of cases like the Biden student loan forgiveness being sort of a test balloon, that's the same thing that we saw during COVID, for example, where the Democrats used the emergency powers to try to push the envelope as much as they could. And they wanted to see how far it would go and how much of our system actually had safety mechanisms to kind of halt the brakes on what was going on. But they continue to try to push and push and push. And then when there is a safety valve, like the U.S. Supreme Court, that says, no, you can't suspend the Constitution and suspend the protections of rights, even in the midst of whatever you want to call a so-called emergency. It doesn't work that way in America. Now they're trying to just say, okay, well, fine, then we'll pack the court. We'll just transform the court into rubber stamping all of these communist socialist and ridiculous powers policies that we prefer. They don't want this system of checks and balances where right and objective truth prevails regardless of party politics. And that's what the Supreme Court should be. It shouldn't just be that Republicans or conservatives win all the time or that Democrats and leftists win all the time. It should be that truth ultimately prevails, the legitimacy of government prevails, and that the government's
obligation to preserve and protect our property rights, our unalienable rights that are given by God that we as human beings possess pre-politically from before even the government system was designed. That should be the only focus of government, and to continue to implement that regardless of these attempts. So we see though this contrast from the presidential ticket all the way down, and even on some of these ballot initiatives and citizens initiatives, constitutional amendments that we can and should be voting on, whether for or against, we should be voting for truth. And so all of these things, this contrast is so clear that if we are truly conserving an America that is founded on the Judeo-Christian worldview, which is the premise of truth, that the only legitimate design of government is to preserve and protect the rights that God gives us, then we will vote against all of these socialist, communist, Marxist, redistribution of wealth, DEI, you know, sort of policies, wherever those tend to crop up, whether that is on the federal level or the state level. And if the states actually could reclaim some of their sovereignty and say, you know, we actually have more power to protect the citizens of our state against an overreaching federal government, I think that the attention and the focus and frankly the fear and panic over a possible outcome that is the socialist agenda in November would be a lot less severe, because we would understand that state sovereignty would override a lot of those concerns. But this is also why so we need to be voting, we need to be engaging, we need to be using the blessings of liberty that we have, and we also need to be praying, because the Bible also calls us to pray for our leaders. And it's not just if they are Christians, if they are doing the right thing, if they are using their powers of government legitimately, even if we ultimately live in a totally pagan society, or in future years there is no such thing as a United States of America, or we, you know, we move to a different country, whatever it is, whoever God establishes as leaders, and his sovereignty does prevail. So we need to be praying for the outcome of all of the elections, all of the ballot initiatives on November 5th. We need to be praying for our leaders, and that they would make the best possible decisions with the legitimacy of government that comes from God himself. Because if they're making the best possible decisions and we are engaging with all of the ways that we can, including first and foremostly prayer, then we will have an impact. And we also will understand that God's sovereignty will continue to prevail, and we can rest our hope ultimately in the person of truth, regardless of where the politics and the policies ultimately go. We'll continue to fight for truth, and we'll continue to engage. But even if, you know, we lose everything, we know that our hope ultimately is in Christ, and we can have peace and confidence ultimately in that our hope is not in partisan politics or a party. Our hope is in the person of Jesus Christ. And so this is why all of these things matter. This is why we talk about the news of the day from a biblical worldview perspective, because we need to analyze not just whether we like, from a subjective standpoint, Biden's efforts to forgive student loans, or we like Trump's or dislike, you know, his agenda to dismantle the Department of Education, you know, all of these different things. A lot of this doesn't come down to a matter of our personal opinion. Sometimes it does. Sometimes it's just a wisdom issue or legitimately a preference issue. But most often, all of these policy considerations, we should have an outcome that is dictated based on our Christian worldview, and that will give us the understanding of where we need to go in policy, because it is predicated on the Christian worldview. And there's so much confidence in that I don't have to necessarily be concerned about, you know, what should I think about all of these things, because I know that if I am substantively grounded in the biblical worldview, then I know what I should believe based on truth. And that should give us a lot of confidence. So I want to welcome in, though, our next guest to talk about another issue of policy that should be founded in truth. It should be founded on protecting Americans. It should be founded in rationality. And so Ra'ig Nationalist, our good friend who wrote the book
the Eggs Benedict option and talks online a lot about the perils of all of our food policy, is joining us now. And the issue that I want to ask you, Charles Cornish, Dale, raw egg nationalist, is about the potential opportunity for an RFK Jr. to go into a Trump administration when, you know, he's a current Democrat, pretty much. I mean, he's an independent, but he's left the Democrat Party, but he's been so focused in terms of policy on understanding where we need to go as a society based on all of these policies surrounding not only the vaccine mandates, but all of the kind of health and human services related issues. So good morning.
It's fantastic to speak to you, Jenna.
Yeah, so let's talk about this, because I think, you know, while there's a lot of speculation that RFK, you know, could be appointed potentially, you know, the head of the CIA, you know, and that kind of thing, and I think that's interesting for its own sake. What could a potential RFK administration appointment actually look like?
Well, I mean, this is a really fascinating situation that we've ended up in. It's worth remembering, first of all, that actually when RFK Jr. announced his candidacy last year, Donald Trump did say that he would appoint a presidential commission to investigate chronic diseases, to investigate why the American public is so unhealthy, why chronic diseases, everything from autism and obesity to Alzheimer's, why these diseases are so prevalent now, and actually try to get to the bottom of them. And when he made his announcement of this presidential commission, he sounded very like RFK Jr. himself. So Trump's obviously taken notice of RFK for some time. He's obviously understood the fact that actually there is a broad appeal to RFK Jr.'s positions on health. And, you know, it fits quite nicely in the broader sort of populist program, the sort of Make America Great Again. You know, we've had RFK say, Make America Healthy Again. I mean, it fits. So there's potential for this to be extremely, extremely radical, actually. I don't think that there could be a more radical appointee for an investigation into the state of America's health than RFK Jr. He's been talking about endocrine disruptors, these horrible chemicals that affect our hormone system and are implicated in chronic diseases. He's been talking about ultra-processed food. He's been talking about vaccines, medical corruption, industry corruption, corruption among the regulators, particularly the FDA, for decades. So actually, I think that there's real potential for this not to be a superficial examination of America's health problems, but actually to try to get to the bottom of it and actually to look particularly at, I think, the corruption in the system, the kind of corrupt incentives that allow, for example, the introduction of basically untested food additives into the food supply. So RFK Jr. talks a lot about processed food and why it's bad, this ultra-processed food that Americans and people throughout the Western world consume more and more of. And part of the big problem is that these foods contain new additives. There's something like 10,000 additives now in American foods. Nobody actually knows how many. And that's what's so crazy about this situation, is that actually the FDA is essentially allowing corporations to introduce untested food additives into the food supply, and they're being implicated in all sorts of chronic diseases, autism particularly, obesity, diabetes, heart disease, etc. So, I mean, I think RFK Jr. is very well placed with his history actually to go after the corrupt corporate interests that are really driving so much of what is wrong with the American food system, so much of what is wrong with the American healthcare system. So I think that we're in a very, very interesting position right now.
Yeah, I think so, too. And this is why I find a figure like RFK Jr. actually fascinating, because, I mean, there's a lot on the policy, if you want to call it the political policy spectrum, that I do disagree with. But there's a lot that I really do agree with. And he's one of the few and probably the most prominent that are talking about these types of issues. And so how long would it actually take to kind of sort out or figure out America's health?
Yeah, that's a very good question. I mean, I think what we have to understand is that the situation that we've arrived in 2024 has been, you know, it's been a festering, growing problem for decades. We're talking maybe 70 years. People have been eating modern ultra-processed foods now for about 70 years, and the health problems have been mounting ever since then. They're getting much worse now and have been getting much worse probably in the last 20 or 30 years. But we are talking about a long-term system, and I think it will definitely take some time. I mean, RFK said in his announcement speech that if, you know, that he thought that he could actually do something within something really meaningful within a single presidential term. And I do think that that is, yes, what you could do is you absolutely could challenge the corrupt vested interests in the food system, big pharma, big agriculture, etc. But I think that actually this is going to have to be a project that will last multiple presidential terms. So what I'd like to see is not just some immediate action to tackle corruption and to educate people and to get people moving at school and in their lives and eating better food. But I also think that there needs to be some kind of longer term policy vision that that focuses on multiple presidential terms, that sees this as a long haul fight. You know, it's taken decades for us to get this unwell, for us to become this unhealthy. And I think it's going to take decades to undo all of the damage that's been done. So this is a long fight, I think. And I'm sure RFK Jr. understands that more than anybody else.
Yeah, and this is why, really good comments, and I completely agree. I mean, this is why we need to have sort of a longer term policy view that America can agree on, rather than kind of these switches back and forth between these really contrasting worldview differences. I mean, we saw the difference between Trump's first 4 years and now the 4 years of Joe Biden, that just had dramatic swings back and forth on policy. And then we can't really accomplish and kind of get the momentum going in the other direction. But again, this is why we need to pray for our country, pray for our leaders, pray for good policy. But we'll be speaking to one of our leaders when we come right back here on Jenna Ellis in the Morning. If ending babies' lives in their mother's womb isn't heartbreaking enough, the Biden-Harris administration punishes those who protect life, including up to 10 years in jail. In a shocking stance, the Democrats' vice presidential nominee, Tim Walz, supports infanticide, meaning the death of newborns. When will this madness end? Preborn's network of clinics is positioned in the highest abortion areas in the country, on standby to protect and love mothers facing unplanned pregnancies. By introducing a woman to her baby through ultrasound and showering her with God's love, her baby's chance at life doubles. But they can't do it without our help. If you are pro-life, please consider a donation of any size to support the mission of Preborn. All gifts are tax deductible and will help defend the defenseless. One ultrasound is just $28, or five ultrasounds is $140. $5,000 will sponsor ultrasounds for Preborn's entire network for a full day. To donate securely, dial #250 and say the keyword baby. That's #250 baby, or go to preborn.com. That's preborn.com/AFR, preborn.com/AFR.
Welcome back to Jenna Ellis in the Morning on American Family Radio.
Welcome back. Well, the House Judiciary Committee Chairman Jim Jordan from the great state of Ohio is issuing a subpoena for information on the political work conducted by the daughter of New York State Supreme Court Judge Juan Merchan. Remember that he is the one who's presiding over Trump's New York ridiculous trial with Alvin Bragg. And so this coming from Fox News. That Jim Jordan sent a letter to the founder and CEO of Authentic Campaigns, a company that's done political work for top Democrat clients like President Biden and Vice President Kamala Harris, accusing him of failing to comply with House investigators' demands for any and all documents related to the prosecution of former President Trump. So Chairman Jordan joins me now. Good morning, sir.
Hey, Jenna, how are you?
I'm great. Thanks so much for joining us. And, you know, glad that you are pursuing this and pursuing the truth in these matters. What do you hope to achieve through this particular subpoena and probe?
Well, I think you got to start from you know, the big picture. This is definitely a conflict. I mean, here's this Judge Mershon, the guy who imposed the gag order on President Trump, still has a gag order on him. The guy who wouldn't let the expert witness, Brad Smith, the expert on campaign finance, wouldn't let him testify in the courtroom. This is the guy who definitely has a conflict, whose daughter made $7 million working for the Harris campaign in 2019, 2020, then worked for the Biden-Harris campaign, her company, Authentic Campaigns. In 1 month alone, made $2 million. So we want to know the communications that have happened recently since this case was brought by Alvin Bragg. So what's happened in 23, 24? What kind of documents, communications, any contract, anything that's happened relative to political activity with Authentic Campaigns and the people who are out to get President Trump? We want to know that information. We've done a couple of different letters. They give us some response back saying, oh, we don't think we should have to comply. We don't think this is appropriate. This is not a real legislative purpose. And we politely told them, that's not your decision to make. That's ours. And by the way, we had the same response early on from someone who worked for Alvin Bragg. And we went to court, and we won in court, and we actually deposed Mark Pomerantz, the guy who wrote the book about this whole thing. So anyway, we sent the subpoena yesterday after trying to get the information just via letter. So we had to go to compulsory means and send the subpoena. And we hope to get that information just as soon as possible.
And what is the suspicion here? I mean, this is the daughter of the judge. And so of course, they're going to likely respond or their supposed defense is, well, you know, these are two totally different individuals. They don't have any sort of, you know, business interactions with each other. The daughter's work doesn't necessarily corrupt the bias of the sitting judge. What is the suspicion that you're probing?
Well, we think that there's a conflict here. We're looking at we need all the information so that we can determine what kind of legislation, if any, we need to pass. Now, we've already passed out of the committee legislation which says you can change venue when you have one of these rogue state prosecutors like Alvin Bragg go after a federal official. We think that you should be able to move that case to federal court, so a change of venue. That legislation's already passed our committee. We may need to adjust that. It hasn't passed the House yet. It hasn't went to the Senate. So we're looking at legislative – that's our job, to do oversight, to get the facts, and then look for ways to improve the situation, whether that's via the power of the purse, whether that's via legislation. That's our job. That's what we're supposed to do under the Constitution. So we're going to do that, but you got to have all the information. And, again, when you think about the daughter of the judge who behaved in the manner that he has, making millions of dollars from the people – who are actually running against the political opponents of the person being targeted by the prosecutor, President Trump. I mean, this to me is like all kinds of legal scholars have said, legal experts have said, this is a definite conflict of interest. But, you know, New York State, they worked their way around that.
Yeah, and this whole thing, in my view, just absolutely stinks in terms of the obvious political targeting of President Trump, the attempt to work their way around the statute of limitations and kind of shoehorn in these misdemeanors into a felony by bootstrapping it to the federal charge and all of these things. And now Donald Trump is set to be sentenced in September. So September 18th is that sentencing date.
Yep.
And so where would this type of legislative oversight, I mean, would that provide him any sort of relief, or would this be looked at a little bit of, you know, ex post facto?
No, not necessarily. We just want the facts. You just want the information. You're right. His sentencing happens to be coming up on the 18th. I think our first letter was sent back on August 1st. We've done the back and forth with the letter. We've given ample time for them to do their search, to look at their records, give their response. They've said on certain categories they don't think they have any documents. Okay, fine. We've asked them to attest to that fact, certify that fact. Other sets of documents that we've requested, they said, well, we have some information there, but we don't think you're entitled to get that. That's not really a legislative purpose. And we, again, said, as I said earlier, we don't think that's your call to make. That's our call to make. We're the Congress of the United States. So this is just a fundamental issue of fairness, equal treatment under the law. We're the Judiciary Committee. It's something we care about. How are we following the Constitution? Is it equal application of the law? Can you really have you know, state prosecutors going after federal officials, going after a former president, going after the Republican nominee for president this time. So all those, I think, are important reasons why we need all the information, the best information, so we can evaluate what's going on.
Absolutely. And I think the American public deserves all of that information. And I'm speaking with Congressman Jim Jordan, who is the House Judiciary Committee chairman. And, you know, and speaking of ensuring fairness in terms of the judiciary, the DOJ issued a through the grand jury, a superseding indictment this week that replaces the former one. And Jack Smith is alleging that this now complies with the Supreme Court's immunity case. When you look at what Justice Thomas said in his dissent about how the appointments clause does not allow for Jack Smith's entire prosecution, is that something that Congress or that the Judiciary Committee is looking at in terms of potential legislation over, you know, some of these appointments of special counsel?
Well, I think it's just clearly the Constitution, and you're right. Justice Thomas made that point in one of his one of the opinions. We actually raised this issue in the committee. One of our members, Thomas Matthew, raised this during a committee hearing, even prior, you know, prior to Judge Cannon's decision, when I believe he was questioning the Attorney General. So, and the Attorney General didn't really have much to say, but I thought it was great that one of our members raised it because, you know, again, we're the Judiciary Committee. We're the committee that's primarily responsible for making sure we're following that great document, the Constitution, in the greatest country ever, that we're following the rules, the principles laid out in that document. So I do think Judge Cannon's decision was right on target. Jack Smith's doing what Jack Smith does. Again, I think all these cases, though, Jenna, are falling apart because they're all based, they're all lawfare. They're all based on politics. And, you know, the Fannie Willis case has fallen apart. Judge Cannon's made her ruling. The January 6th case is, you know, Jack Smith had to file the superseding indictment this week. And then, of course, you got the ridiculous case up in New York with Alvin Bragg, which frankly should be postponed, the sentencing, because President Trump has asked to postpone the sentencing. Alvin Bragg has indicated he didn't have a problem with that. The fact that this judge has not done that makes no sense to me. Normally, that is just like if both parties are okay with moving the sentencing back, it's usually moved back. But this judge, again, I think maybe underscoring his partisanship, hasn't made that ruling yet. We'll see what he does. But it seems to me it should be postponed until after the election.
Yeah, I agree. And, you know, and in my experience in courtrooms, generally, when the parties agree, the judge just says, OK, you know, because that's not something that necessarily he or she should dictate. The parties get to determine kind of, you know, their process. And obviously, you know, with the judge presiding, but it does seem like political bias there. And so I really appreciate that you are investigating this, looking at the legislative oversight capacity, using those resources. And I want to ask you as well about the Zuckerberg issue, because he wrote you a letter basically admitting that he complied with the Biden administration's demands for censorship on social media, that the New York Post story that was not Russian disinformation that was suppressed during the 2020 election.
Yep.
This to me was just kind of odd timing. What did you make of this letter?
Well, first of all, to the timing, I mean, we've been doing a year and a half investigation. We've, I think, deposed 12 different folks, over a dozen folks from Facebook, from line level employees all the way up to the number three person at Meta, Sir Nick Clegg, former Deputy Prime Minister of Great Britain. And we were going to, you know, we're going to do our investigation like we do all our investigations in a robust and in constitutional fashion. But we're going to be aggressive and do it. I think at some point he just said, like, I'm just going to come clean with the facts. And that's why we got this letter. Second, I think what he points out in the letter are kind of four key points. One, Biden-Harris administration pressured Facebook to censor, primarily conservatives, too. Fact number two, they in fact did censor. Facebook did censor. Fact number three, they throttled back. Part of that censorship was throttling back the Hunter Biden laptop story, which, of course, we know had an impact on the 2020 presidential election. Fact number four, no more Zuckerbucks are going to be spent this cycle, which is great news for the election process in the 2024 election. So I think those are four key facts. And it just underscores how serious this censorship effort from the left is. I mean, I would argue the main reason Robert F. Kennedy endorsed President Trump last week is because he sees the Republican Party as the party standing up for the First Amendment. The Democrat Party is now the party of censorship. And Robert F. Kennedy had a great line. He said, when history doesn't typically look at the good guys in history aren't typically the ones who favored censorship. He used that same line when he testified in front of our committee. So that's what I think really is a fundamental issue at stake in this election is, do you believe in the First Amendment? Vote Republican. If you're for censorship, you can vote with the other guys.
Yeah, so such a difference and a contrast in worldview, in government powers and how they are used, and also just a fundamental belief in preserving the Constitution and the rights that we have that are God-given here in America, that our Constitution obligates government to preserve and protect. And so the First Amendment is a very, very big one. And so what was also interesting about this letter is that this is a complete contrast to what Secretary Mayorkas testified to in front of the Senate. And so we remember that even though you all in the House filed impeachment against Secretary Mayorkas and, you know, on the border issue and some of that, is there talk at all in Congress about potentially reviving this or even potentially perjury allegations? Because clearly, you know, if Zuckerberg is right, then did Mayorkas lie?
Well, I think Mayorkas has given the country false information numerous times. And it's interesting, the language he used when Senator Hawley was asking him the question, he said it's unequivocally false that we pressured big tech to censor. And turns out that's not what happened, because Mark Zuckerberg's big tech, and he told us what exactly happened. That's the same language, though, by the way, that Mayorkas used when he said, we didn't turn down security requests from President Trump's Secret Service detail. And then 5 days later, if you remember just back in July, 5 days later, he said, well, the Secret Service pointed out, well, there were times when, in fact, we were asked, President Trump's detail asked for help, and they were turned down. So two times he's used the exact same language, and it's been false. So, I mean, it's something we'll look at, but again, you know, this is the Garland Justice Department who would have to prosecute. I don't think that's likely to happen.
Which is so frustrating, Chairman Jordan, for the American people who just watch, you know, all of these officials just get away with all of this, and they're not held to accountability. And meanwhile, you know, Donald Trump is set for sentencing on a ridiculous, you know, sham case out of New York. And that contrast, yeah. I mean, where will be the accountability be for some of these bad actors?
Well, the ultimate accountability is in 68 days when the American people say enough of this, enough of these bad policies, enough of this, these agencies being used against the American people, enough of these agencies pressuring companies to censor the American people, and they elect President Trump as the next president, J.D. Vance as our next vice president. That's the ultimate accountability. And then with the new Justice Department, we'll see what happens. But the real accountability is you got to change who the commander in chief of this great country is. Who that individual is. And we all know it needs to be President Trump. That's why I'm working my tail off. We're traveling right now to another state to help colleagues and hopefully potential colleagues and Republicans in the Congress. And we just need to win, because if we don't, the bad stuff's going to continue. I mean, I always say in 4 years' time, we went from a secure border to no border, and the Democrats just made the borders are their nominee. We went from safe streets to record crime, and the Democrats just made the lady who said, let's bail out the rioters in 2020. They just made her their nominee. We went from $2 gas to $4 gas, and the Democrats just made the person who was against fracking their nominee. And we went from stable prices to record inflation, and the person who did the tie-breaking vote on the bill that caused all the inflation, they just made her their nominee. So that's the key.
Well said, and you are one of the best advocates for the Constitution and for truth in Congress. Thank you so much. We are all praying for you, for the rest of the House Judiciary Committee and for Congress. So continue the good work, Chairman Jim Jordan. And that's all the time that we have today for Jenna Ellis in the Morning. Make it a great day. You can always reach me and my team, Jenna@AFR.net.
The views and opinions expressed in this broadcast may not necessarily reflect those of the American Family Association or American Family Radio.
We'd like to thank our sponsors, including Preborn. Preborn has rescued over 200,000 babies from abortion, and every day their network clinics rescue 200 babies' lives. Will you join Preborn in loving and supporting young moms in crisis? Save a life today. Go to preborn.com.